And I think I'll introduce our speakers, and I'll let you guys take it from here. First, we have Karina Huang, who has come from Vietnam. After Karina speaks, we will have Lucy Fisk, who has worked with refugees and asylum seekers, both in Western Australia and here. So thank you so much for coming.
Yeah. Thank you. Good afternoon. Can you hear me? Great. Firstly, I'd like to thank Dr. Jean Sherman for having me here, and I thank the foundation and the university for inviting me and give me an opportunity to share with you some of the Vietnamese boat people stories. I came across these newspapers in the West Australian last week, and the journalist said, the refugee situation is so complex that distilling it down to individual stories is often the only way to understand it. So I think what I'm going to show you next may be proof what he said that is somewhat true. I'm going to walk you through a little bit of the Vietnam exodus through my personal stories, but I also would like to acknowledge some of the visitors here today. This is your stories as well. The significance of this mugshot is that I was given refugee status. And that's when we were able to have the chance to have the picture taken with our name, our birth year, and a boat number. So if you ever talk to a boat person, they probably would not remember anything else, but the boat number is the first thing. I always remember my boat number is VT075. And the Vietnam War, I don't want to go through to talk about Vietnam War because we're all familiar with it in one way or another, but it's the end of the war and then the aftermath that caused this largest exodus in modern history. What I'd like to show you next is a 3-minute documentary film that took place in Saigon on April 29, 1975, and that was the last day of Saigon.
Docks on Tuesday morning were crammed with thousands of Vietnamese desperate to escape from Saigon by any means possible. Large old American landing craft had been hit with more than 1,000 people who were going to attempt the impossible, try and sail down the river to the sea. The sandbags were to stop the B-40 rockets and comedy shells that would certainly be fired at them in their journey. The harbor was full of small cargo ships, full of people, whose only way out now was this desperate, perhaps suicidal attempt. As we, the press and the Americans evacuating, made our drive through Saigon to the American embassy, people, mostly families, pleaded with us for a seat, and they hung to the coach. The coach behind us suddenly accelerated, and children hanging on the side fell off and under the wheels. The city was suddenly choked with people, lorries and cars, all chasing one American evacuation convoy after the other. Jams that the Vietnamese police tried to clear with their rifles, but people were no longer afraid of them. There was now so much more to be afraid of. But then suddenly we too, the 40 or 50 of us in the safety of the coaches, had to get out and fight our way to the American compound where the helicopters were landing to fly us and the thousands more out of the country. Seeing us in the streets with our bags, the Vietnamese followed. Any chance they thought was better than none. But the embassy gates were closed, and we, like the frightened Vietnamese and their families, had to fight and claw our way up. And we did claw, and we did fight. And if it wasn't for one single American Marine, whose name I didn't have the chance or time to discover, we would never have climbed our way to our evacuation. He hauled us up, kicking and punching Vietnamese, who were clambering over our bodies. Ashamed and exhausted, we took our turn in the long crowd of refugees inside the embassy compound and waited for the helicopters to come down for us. One by one they came in, landing on an improvised pad in the car park. All had come from American aircraft carriers steaming 20 miles out in the South China Sea. Marines guarded each of the 4 embassy gates as the lucky people ran 30 at a time to their transport to safety. In the first 6 hours of Tuesday, over 1,500 people were airlifted out this way. almost as many more were still waiting their turn. Our turn came just as it began to get dark, a little after 7:30. Evacuees from the besieged city of. And 30 minutes later, we landed safely on our carrier off the South Vietnamese coast. Michael Nicholson, news at 10, aboard the USS Hancock.
We all know that when we are in fears or you're desperate, you will reach into your inner strength, and it's really amazing how my mom was able to get all of her 7 little children and 2 nieces into that compound among that chaos. I was the second one in the front row. I was 12 years old. And all we had was a sip of swimming pool water in 22 hours. All waited fearfully, impatiently, desperately to be missed the very last helicopter. So we fought our way out of the compound at the end of the whole ordeal. But we had no home to go to after we left the compound because the communists came over and our house was confiscated. Within hours, we became homeless. So the Vietnamese communist government gathered all of the military soldiers, the military personnel, doctors, lawyers, teachers, those who were associated with the previous government, and put them in political prison. My father was one of them, but he wasn't gathered by the government. He was captured on the 29th of April. But we have lost touch with my dad before that. So for a month or a couple of months, my mom had no idea if her husband was still alive or dead. And we were homeless. She has 7 little kids to look after. And my grandmom and both grandmoms. It was quite difficult for my mom to survive in that condition, not knowing if her husband was still alive or not. And later she found that my father was captured and kept in a prison in the jungle near his military base. And he was the chief of the police department. So now we know dad was alive. So there's a chance we will see him again. However, we do not know when we will see him again. Every day, we live with this hope that he might come home today. And that day did come, but not until 14 years later. So that's happened to those who are involved with the government. But with their families, their wives, children, elderly, those who live in the city side, were forced to go to areas that's called new economic zones. Basically, it's rural, uncultivated land. And these city people were shipped there and forced to stay without help, without shelter, without food and tools, and they have to do what it takes to survive. A lot of those persecutions and fears of the unknowns and unable to earn a living, I couldn't go to school past 9th grade. My mom couldn't get a job. She couldn't trade anything. Everything she does is illegal. So how could she feed her 7 children? So my mom ended up trading in the black market, from diamonds to currency exchange to sell at MSG to sugar cane, whatever it takes. But that wasn't enough for my mom to send us out by boat until 1978, when Vietnam had won Cambodia. Young adolescents, 16, 17, were sent to fight in Cambodia, and many of them did not come home. And one day, my mom heard that her friend's son went to Cambodia to fight, died within the first week, and that's when it hit home. And my mom realized that it's only a matter of time when her children will be sent to Cambodia. Because of my father's military background, we could not skip that. So she finally had to make that choice and let us go. So we then became the statistics of the boat people. But when these boat people get on the boat to South China Sea, often these boats were not made to go on the ocean. But in addition to dealing with the condition of the boat, the storm, forces of nature, and all the dangers that happened along the way, I now realize that the minute we step our foot on the boat, our chance for survival was probably 10%. But I was too young then and also was not told of what would happen to us. I was just ordered to leave. But not only that, I had two little sister and brother to look after, and I was only 16. One day I had my mom, my family, friends. The next day, I was all alone with two little sister and brother to look after. So we got on the boat, and the first night out, we were hit by a huge storm. The boat was quite large. It's about a bit longer than this room, sideways, and the width is 5 meters. Now we had about 70 people. How many people you think that boat had taken across South China Sea? 373. We sat in that condition for 7 days and 7 nights with knees to our chin. So when the storm hit us, any time a wave crashing down on the boat, we thought all 373 people would go down to the bottom of South China Sea any minute. Death was that close. So when the storm subsided, we all sat among each other's vomit, and we pray, we cry, we scream together, and we stay together in that same condition with our movements for 7 days and 7 nights. But there's a lot more that happened during that time. So these are some of the boats that we took out of Vietnam in South China Sea, or that to Hong Kong. This boat here was rescued in South China Sea in 1982. It was 152 people. So with our boat, it would probably just be 4 layers of that. But it's not just the storm that we had to deal with. Sometimes the boat was overcrowded, that it actually fell apart. Or the engine fell and the boat drifted endlessly until we ran out of food and water. And that is when cannibalism took place. There was a gentleman who contributed his story in my book, and he told the story of how he had rescued a 15-year-old boy off the boat right before he was about to be eaten by his own boatmates. And for our boat, we actually lost a few people because we did run out of water and food. When we lost the first person, everybody was so exhausted and too tired, but we thought, well, she's an older person, maybe because she couldn't handle it. But when the second one died, and then the third one, and everybody realized that it could be us the next day because there's no more food and water. And we are still in the middle of the vast ocean, and we looked around us, there's only sky and water. But the worst part was for me to witness the families of the dead ones wailing and screaming and hanging on to the dead body so that they can bury their mom or their dad, but we couldn't. We had to throw the bodies to the ocean. The worst nightmare of the boat people at that time was not to be encountering the storms or hungry or thirsty, but to endure the pirates. When the Thai pirates get to one of our boats, they would rape women and young girls repeatedly in front of their loved ones. They would throw babies to the ocean if the kids get in the way. They would kill husbands or brothers or sons if they tried to resist while they were raping their loved ones. And they also abduct the young girls, and they have never been returned, and nobody knows what happened to them. They would use the plier to pull the gold teeth out of people's mouth. They use hammer to slam your wrist if you have a watch or a bracelet that they want to take from you. If the Thai pirates got to you and you had already been attacked before and you had nothing left for them to take from you, they would take the anger out of you even more. They will be more violent toward you just because you have nothing for them to take from you. I've interviewed a lady who was, well, I started to interview her about her journey because I heard that she had endured one of the worst boat journey among us all. She agreed to have a talk with me. We had coffee, and we were about to set the date and time. And 2 days later, her husband called me and said, "Do not ever see my wife or talk to her again. She hasn't been well since you talked to her about just the topic alone." So 30-some years later, her wound was still so raw. And I think that we all can understand why. It probably would be difficult for her to heal for the rest of her life. Sometimes a book we attacked 23 times, like it said here. But in my book, there's a gentleman who talked about his boat being attacked 7 times within a matter of hours, one after another. The statistics shown that about 1 million Vietnamese and Chinese people made it to shore during this exodus. But the UNHCR estimated 1 out of 3 perished at sea. So you can say about 250,000 people die of the exodus in South China Sea before they reach anywhere. And now that we talk about the endurance that we have to face and all these challenges on the water, and then we eventually see land, hopes came. Everybody, it doesn't matter how tired you were, you just wake up because you see land, you know, safety is near. And it's happened to us. We finally saw Malaysia shore, and we tried to come close. And all of a sudden, we were shot at by the military boat. And then they came out and pulled our boat out of the middle of the ocean. They came on our boat with ammunition. They robbed everything we had, including our navigating tools, compass, map, everything we own. And I remember sitting on the bottom of the boat, looking up to this man who was uniform, suited, tall, intimidating looking, with an AK-47 pointed at my brother's neck because he has a gold necklace on him. So I just shakily removed the necklace and gave it to him. At the same time, I kept begging him, "Don't shoot, don't shoot." But I said in Vietnamese. And, you know, I didn't think much of it. I was so scared that I just, you know, react. But years later, my brothers and sisters reminded me that sometimes in the middle of the night, they would hear me scream out, "Đừng bắn, đừng bắn." It means don't shoot. It must have been, you know, the memory that I had back then. So that's the pushback policy that the Malaysian government had during that time toward the boat people. This boat here was arrived at the shore of Malaysia, and they sunk. And only the boat people from inside swam out and tried to help them. They did not get help from other people, from the government. Life in the refugee camp was just as challenging as the sea journey sometimes. Because when we get to the refugee camp, the condition was bad. The torture, the rape, everything else was still going on there too. In Malaysia, they had set up a camp for 5,000 people at first, and they ended up with 45,000 within a few months. We'll be lucky if we come to a camp that have shelter like that, or a refugee camp that have kids locked behind barbed wire for years. These 3 kids are Cambodian. Unfortunately, after 2 years behind the barbed wire in the refugee camp in Indonesia, they were forced to repatriate because they were not given refugee status. But for me, this is the refugee camp in Hong Kong. This is the regular, everyday scene. In Hong Kong, back then, every day they receive on an average of 600 to 4,500 boat people per day. And that's why it is always crowded like that. Now, this was my refugee camp. This picture was taken 12 years ago. Imagine 30 years ago. It was a lot, the jungle was more dense, trees were bigger, because at one time it housed 40,000 boat people. But when we first arrived, what happened was we made it to Indonesia, and then the government put us on a boat and pulled us to another island. They said we were taken to a refugee camp. But by the way, we sunk our boat when we arrived in Indonesia so that they would not send us back. So that's how we got to be accepted to Indonesia. So the Indonesian government put us on the boat, took us to this island and unloaded all of the boat people and they left. It was about evening time and the sun came down so quickly and we didn't know what was going on. In my mind, I was going to a refugee camp where there's shelters and, you know, people were there greeting us and give us food or a place to sleep or what have you. But no, we looked around, it's only boat people. And in the front was the ocean, in the back was the jungle. Everybody was so afraid. So we just sat on the sand beach, stretched out, hundreds of people just sat there on the same spot, thinking that maybe they went to get fuel and they will come back. And then the night came, we waited, and then a huge thunderstorm came down. Everybody was soaking wet and shivering through the night. We sat at the same spot. The morning, we waited to get dried up by the sun and stared at the horizon, waiting for that boat to come back. My sister, my brother, and I, the three of us, just hang on to each other on the same spot. We looked out to the horizon every day for 3 months. Nobody came back. But during that time, more boat people arrived at the same little island. There was no food. We found some drinking water in the ocean, I mean in the jungle, but that's about it. So every day, people die, especially children and elderly. I had held a dead baby and put her in a coffin, it's a wooden box, when I was only 16. And I also helped deliver a baby in the middle of the night too. That's just the testimony of human strength. When you have to, you just do. So that's the condition where we were. And 3 months later, we were spotted out by the helicopter of the Red Cross. And that's when they know that there are thousands of these people lost in this jungle waiting for the outside world to come in and rescue them. So that at that point on, we were established as a refugee camp. And 10 months later, we left the camp and went to America. But it was just not the loss of these people at sea. There were both people who arrived in refugee camp and died of malaria, diarrhea, you know, lack of food and medicines. And it happened to my cousin, the one who's standing up there. My auntie was in the same situation. Her husband was in political prison. Her 4 sons were about to be sent to Cambodia, so she took the risk and escaped with all of them. And one of them died by malaria. So every time I visited my aunt in California, she talked about how much she wanted to find his grave, how much she wanted to bring his ashes home. But I know that it's not just the pain of losing her son that's eaten her up inside, but it's the guilt that she has for leaving her dead son behind. And her other 3 sons became master in engineering, business owner, or school teacher. That hurts. It's a mother. You know, she kept thinking of her son who was left behind in the jungle. As, of course, he's dead. But with our culture, every year we have a ceremony. We will burn incense for them. We will clean the grave for them. And I told my aunt someday I'll go and find his remains for him. Without knowing how to get there, where he was buried, what the grave looks like, if it's still there or not, and it wasn't marked. And in 1998, I did the impossible. I went to the jungle. Just to describe how I got to that island could be a book for you to read. But when we got there, not only we came to this site that was so thick that with naked eyes you cannot see any grave in there, and we cleared the jungle with an advice of a farmer who insisted for me to look in that area. We found 8 graves, all looked the same. But these are 8 out of 500, both people died on that island back in 1979, 1980. And we decided to excavate 1 grave, and that was the only one I needed to look for. Everything my aunt buried for her son was still there. So I came back and established a website to tell the story, just to share hope with other people. And in 2008, I was contacted by some families in America and asked me to help them to go back to these jungles. And that led to what I'm doing now. For the last 3 years, every year I will go back to my former refugee camps, which is now still uninhabited, once or twice a year with families to find the graves of the loved ones. We found 12. We rebuilt 16 graves so far, but I found nearly 100 graves. And anytime we found one, we would clean the tombstone, paint the name, took the pictures and post them on the internet, and more family would contact me. My latest trip was April this year. An 87 years old woman came with me to find the grave of her husband. She tried it 2 times, but she couldn't find it until her grandson found the picture of her husband's grave in my website, on the website. So I brought her back with me. And every time I took one of these trips, I told my husband and my daughter that it's my last trip. And it hasn't stopped. Just before I finish, a few weeks ago, I received an email from a lady in California. She wrote to me and she said, "Karina, grave number 17 on your website is my grandfather's grave." So I opened up my website, looked at it and see what grave it was, because I didn't know who it was. Number 17 was actually the very first tombstone I came across when I went back to that jungle. And now I learned that he was on my boat. Same boat, VT-075. So with all of these stories, I decided to write a book just to share some of the experiences for the younger generation, for my daughter, my nieces and nephews, whom parents are also book people, but now it's a book for all of you as well. It's a collection of 38 short stories told by the survivor of the Exodus and also of foreigners who used to work or rescue the boat people. I'm sorry, I jumped ahead of myself because I became a bit more emotional now with all of these pictures. This is my second trip that I came back with that man there. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia. He contacted me and asked me to help him find the grave of his mom. He was 12 years old when he escaped to Malaysia and heard that his mom escaped to Indonesia and died there. And she came to Gugu Island at the same time I was. So we went back to the jungle, and the way I found his mom's grave was similar to the way I found my cousin's grave. It's another miracle. So this is my third trip. We found more graves. Each one is really amazing of how we find a grave. And so far, there hasn't been any grave that I set out to look that we haven't found yet. That's an 87-year-old woman. Every day, she would be the first to wake up, and she would use her walking cane and walk up to the hill and sat by her husband's grave every day to pray, burn incense for him, just to be there by his spirit. Some of the graves that we found, there's no remains left but a few pieces of bones like that. And one grave we found nothing but a necklace with a heart pendant. Belongs to a 14-year-old girl. So there, that's my book. I don't like to talk about the book. It's all, I have the books here, you can have a look in, you know, at it. And I'd like to now leave the time for our next guest speaker. And if you have questions, you're welcome to ask me later. Thank you for listening.
Wow, that's quite an amazing journey and life story, and amazing work that you do, and no easy act to follow. I'm a very boring academic, I'm afraid, so I'm going to come at this a little bit differently. We're talking today about boat people, and indeed I'm going to talk about boat people, and in particular I want to talk about our responses to boat people. But I would also like to say that there is no good way to be a refugee, whether you spend years and years in a camp in northern Kenya, whether you evade police on the streets of Cairo, whether you get on a boat across the South China Sea, there's no good way to be a refugee. I'd like to begin by telling the story of the MS St. Louis, which some of you may already be familiar with. The MS St. Louis left Germany in 1939. Sorry, I'm also a little bit emotional from your speech. Speak up. Sorry, I'll try to speak into the microphone. There were 937 people on board the MS St. Louis. They were all Jews fleeing Nazi Germany. And they went to Cuba seeking asylum. They actually did have tourist visas for Cuba, but the Cuban authorities said, well, you're not here for tourism purposes, and refused them entry. They stayed in the port in Havana for about 2 weeks while negotiations went on, and they were refused entry. The boat then sailed to Florida in the US, where it was also refused entry. The boat was then forced to go back to Europe, and the captain had planned that he would run the boat aground in shallow reefs off the UK to force a country to take his passengers. Fortunately, he didn't have to do that. A number of countries agreed that they would take the passengers. The UK, France, Netherlands, and Belgium, I think. Someone else may be able to add one more to that list. Now, what happened to the passengers, to every single individual passenger, is not known. The 288 who went to the UK are believed to have survived the war. Those who went to the Netherlands, Belgium, and France, of course, those countries were soon occupied by the Nazis. And researchers have tried to track exactly what happened to all of the passengers and have managed to confirm that at least 260 people died in Auschwitz and Sobibor. There are other estimates that put it even higher. Now, the reason I tell you this is that countries have always tried to turn around boats and to refuse entry, to want visas. And I think we need to ask ourselves a little bit about that. After World War II, and particularly the Holocaust, where 6 million people plus were killed, and millions more were displaced and left homeless and with no nationality, the world said never again, and set up a number of mechanisms to try to make sure that this wouldn't happen again. One of them was signing the Refugees Convention. Now, the Refugees Convention really only has two substantive protections in it, or rights for refugees. One is the right to cross a border without the proper documents, if you're fleeing for your life. The second one is not to be returned to a country where you may be tortured, imprisoned arbitrarily, or killed. So they're really the only two rights. That second one is called... Is anyone who speaks French here? Non-refoulement? But in the non-refoulement. Or as Australians say, non-refoulement? And that's important because the Refugees Convention doesn't say a country has to offer residency or citizenship to someone. It says you have to do two things. You have to let people cross your border so that you can begin to ask questions. Why have you come? What would happen? What has happened? The second one is that if you've made an assessment that their life would be in grave danger if they were returned, you must not return them to that country. You don't have to take them into your own. You can negotiate a settlement somewhere else, but you must not return them to somewhere where their life would be in danger. Now, the Australian government is going to have a bipartisan meeting, Monday morning. And on the cards are Malaysia, Nauru, PNG, anywhere but here, basically. About 10 years ago, we sent roughly 1,700 people to Nauru and to Manus Island. And we're looking to do something similar again. The High Court has said that Australia's deal with Malaysia can't go ahead, that it's not lawful as the law stands. And the main reason for that is that Malaysia regularly detains and canes and deports refugees and asylum seekers, so including refugees holding a UNHCR card. Now, the Australian government solicitor in court wasn't arguing that this doesn't happen and wasn't arguing that Malaysia is going to pass laws to prevent this from happening or that the Australian government will monitor to make sure this doesn't happen, simply that the MOU means it won't happen to people. The Australian court said, well, no, that's not a good enough, that's not a proper legal protection. Once people are outside your jurisdiction, you can't guarantee their safety. But once they've entered your jurisdiction, an obligation to do that has been raised. In a way, I'd like to be able to say that Australia's out on its own with this, but we're not. Greece, well, the European Union receives about 230,000 new asylum applications each year. It fluctuates slightly, but not a lot. Most of those come in through Greece, Italy, and Spain, which simple geography would explain why. Greece last year received 25,000 new asylum applications, and it received very many more people who actually arrived, but most people who arrive in Greece don't even get to lodge an application. First the boats get pushed back. There are also very credible reports of them scuttling boats, dragging them back towards the Turkish coast and dumping them. When people do make landfall, they are generally detained, very often beaten up, driven to the Turkish border, and dumped across the border at nightfall. If you do manage to lodge a claim in Greece, in 2008 there were 5,500 claims lodged by Iraqis. How many do you think were approved? Someone who knows the answer. Zero. Not one single Iraqi claim was approved. The same year, there were 25,000 new asylum applications determined, with a success rate of 0.04%. Now, in Europe, they've got an agreement called the Dublin Agreement, which says that if asylum seekers move on within the EU, then they are returned to their first country of entry, and that's where their asylum claim must be assessed. So if you've arrived through Greece and managed to not be detained, beaten up and pushed across the border, but you quickly work out that life in Greece isn't going to offer you very much and you move on and try to seek asylum elsewhere, you're going to be returned there. In January this year, the European Court of Human Rights found against Belgium, just happened to be that the case was against Belgium, found that its attempts to return an Afghan asylum seeker to Greece breached the principle of non-refoulement, that by returning an asylum seeker to Greece, you are essentially breaching the promise not to send someone back where their life is in danger. It's very, very similar to what Australia is wanting to do to Malaysia, and I think Karina's experiences in Malaysia bring that into very sharp relief for us all. 11 EU countries have now suspended returns to Greece, which is great. That's wonderful, and I'm very pleased about that. And I wish I could say, though, that I feel heartened for the future of asylum seeking. But unfortunately, I don't. I think we've had some appalling political leadership, bipartisan, over the last couple of decades on this issue in Australia. But opinion polls consistently show around 80% of Australians support policies which are aimed at deterring boat people. And I think we need to ask ourselves, Why do we want to deter boat people? What do we actually believe in? When we hear stories about the St. Louis, I think everyone is rightfully horrified. Why is it different today? Why is what we are doing different to Canada and the US? My maths isn't very good, 65, 70 years ago. Sorry, I'll just check where I was going. So we keep seeing, and I think one of the key problems is that we keep seeing refugees as a problem. I don't see refugees as a problem. I see our response to refugees as a problem. And I think that we need to consider what sorts of values and principles we hold dear. What principles is it that we want to build our society on and that we would wish to protect? And in which case, how would those principles guide us in our response to people arriving by boat, to Indigenous Australians, to a whole bunch of different groups of people that I think we don't treat anywhere near as well as we should? So I think we need to stop seeing refugees as a problem. I think we need to ask ourselves a bunch of questions about who we are and what we want. I think we also need to start recognising that refugees are people with a whole range of characteristics and qualities and skills and failings and hopes and dreams, same as anyone else. Refugees are people that may be working today as a writer and storyteller, as doctors, as a tradesperson, you know, any range of occupations, volunteering at the local PTA, the local school, community sporting groups. There are some high flyers that we can point to. Former US Secretary of State Madeleine Albrecht was a refugee from then Czechoslovakia. Anne Doe, the Australian comedian, also was a Vietnamese boat person. Who else have we got? I can't think of a name. But anyway, even if you don't achieve that level of acknowledgement and recognition, there are good people in amongst us everywhere who are refugees, and that ought not be what determines who they are and how we treat them. So I'd like to close, in fact, with the words from a man who spent 4 years in an Australian detention centre. And he said, "You see, Lucy, it's a massive thing to live with the title of refugee, which is something you are bestowed on. You didn't choose it. You didn't pick it. You thought you were making a freedom of movement to get out of a problem that you were in, and now you're in another type of trouble, and there's a title for you to carry on. It is very understandable that a lot of people don't want to be called by that title, and as soon as you go out, that's the first thing that you get. Not many of us feel comfortable with that, but some of us feel like, I don't know, I would like to, this is something that is on me now. I would like to define it the way that I fulfill it. So yes, I'm a refugee. I'm from Iran. But I'm a human being with these passions, these emotions, this laughter and these crying moments. You know, like any other human being. And that is the way that I am that refugee."
Are there any questions or anything from you?
Miracle stories that Karina told with in relation to finding those graves. You know, people who pick up the photos here are asked to go onto the website and upload them, or we've had an archivist here all the time uploading photos, and we hoped that we would find someone who connected to these photos, but you know, the chances were small and tiny. And the archive also, do you know the story, Karina? No. The archive also couldn't be really well documented in the normal way, because we didn't have the names of the people or the time, you know, dates or anything except for these images, and in some cases just a few words, which humanize them but don't identify them. Anyway, our general manager, Donna Merrilies, her parents were ambassadors. Her father was an ambassador in an Australian ambassador, various countries of the world. And they're retired now in Burgundy in France. And next door to them lives a woman who had spent her youth in Vietnam. And Donna sent this catalogue, the catalogue that belongs to this exhibition, to her parents, as she usually does, because she plays a big role in developing these catalogues, so just to show her parents what she is doing. And she decided to send a second catalogue for the woman next door, who lives next door to them in Burgundy, because she grew up in Vietnam, and Donna thought that this woman might be interested in seeing a show by a Vietnamese artist in Sydney, Australia. There's a French woman. The woman, after she left Vietnam, you know, went to school and continued and became finally an archaeologist at the Louvre Museum in Paris. And she just retired. So these are people in their mid-70s. So she received the catalogue as a gift from her next-door neighbours, Dollar's parents, and she didn't have time to do anything about it, read it. She just glanced at it and thought, this is very interesting. And she was going on a train from Burgundy to Paris to her farewell party at the Louvre Museum to say thank you for the years of service and so on. She opened the catalogue and it just fell open at page 45, and there she was. Yes, as a 13-year-old girl at a Catholic school in Vietnam. And when you think of the level of coincidence that involved, it's similar to the perhaps much sadder stories of the graves. But here was a woman who was airlifted out of Vietnam, French woman with her family at the end of the war. They left everything behind. You saw the scenes there. I mean, everything taken meant one less person, so they just went with the clothes that were on them. Went to France, then via a Thai refugee camp, ended in California, went back to Saigon, to Ho Chi Minh City. I met him. We planned the show in Australia. He brought 150 kilos of photos to this exhibition. We chose only a few for the catalogue. One of those few was this woman, Annie. We sent the catalogue to France, and Annie found herself. So, you know, it shows you miracles do happen, really. We were determined, if at all possible, we would find someone, never believing for a moment that we could. So what is happening now, Erin? Questions. Well, who is the person who should be receiving the questions? I think it's not me. No, it's not me. This is your gig. But I had to share that story.
I actually don't think I should be answering them, but I'm happy to moderate. Maybe we have questions for Lucy or for Karina. Both these amazing speeches. Thanks. Alex.
I just have I'm trying to make my statement a question. So give me a minute. Okay. So the story that you... Okay. Yeah, I'm completely moved like you were. You've become a key for people to connect to their past. Can you tell me how that makes you feel, that you can help people now with the graves that you visit in Indonesia?
I think the question is, how do I feel about helping these families connecting with to find the graves of their loved ones? It feels great. And I live with those families and their emotions and their happiness and sadness every time I went back with them. And the first time that I was asked to go and help, I didn't know what I can do, but I couldn't say no, because I know that I've made it back there and no one had done it yet. These islands were not on the map. I went to Indonesian consulate in Singapore and asked for my way to the bigger islands near these little villages, and the Indonesian consulate members didn't even know about these islands. There was no transportation, there's no directions, no way to get there. And then once you're there, wandering in the jungle and finding graves of people you don't know, it's even more difficult. So yes, I'm very happy that I can help, but also it's very painful. However, I think not only it offers healing for those families, but it's helped offer healing for me as well. I think that I've got on with life, I'm doing well, but nobody could ever forget these kind of experiences. I remember every day in the first 3 months in Gugu Island, every morning when I woke up and held my sister and my brother's hands and they're still moving, then I know that we have another day. Because we could die any day on that island. And the responsibility was so big on me. At 16, I used to ask God if he ever wanted to take us, take my sister and my brother first so I can kill myself after them. But if he took my life away, who's going to look after them? And that's when I heard that these people that were sent to Malaysia, among them were unaccompanied minors. I felt very angry inside, because children should not be endured that, regardless of whether they met the criteria or not. So, yes, I'm happy to help these families, and I continue to as long as I could. And by the way, all of the trips that I've made back to Indonesia is self-funded. As long as my husband is willing to look after my daughter for me, I'll go. I used to work for the U.S. consulate, so every year I only have 2 weeks of vacation, and that's where I spend my vacation time. But it's not everybody in your life would have a chance to do this kind of work, even if you want to. So it's something that I have the opportunity to do, and I love it. Yes. It's my chance of exercise every year, because I don't work out at home, but when I'm in that jungle, I climb different mountains every day. Because imagine if I took six families with me, and the graves were in three different locations. The families that I took them to, one grave, had them set up, find people to help them clean the area and rebuild the graves. Then I move on to the next island and let them there. So these families only have to hike up and down one mountain per day. I get three mountains to climb. So there. Other questions? You might want to know why I'm here. I was a refugee in America. But I married Robert, who was born in Italy, migrated to Australia when he was four by a bigger boat. And we were married. I took Robert to America, and 5 years ago we decided to move to Perth because his parents are getting quite old. And I'm glad we moved here. I am comfortable and happy here. Yes, and my parents, my sisters and brothers are all well. They all live in America now. Yes.
We put our hands together for Corinna Huang, Mr. Fisk, and Jean Sherman. Thank you so much.